This is Slick Joe Fick, and you're listening to Memphis Flash.
I'm Brad Brickadall.
And I'm Mark Schaefer.
Mark and I spent so much time talking Elvis with each other, we decided to invite more people to the conversation.
If you're a lifelong fan or new to the world of all things Elvis, we're glad you're here.
Welcome to Memphis Flash.
Hey, Brad, we're back. Great to see you, buddy.
Good to see you, Mark. Excited about episode 22 today.
Is it 22? Wow. Okay.
It sure is.
I'm excited to talk to Gordon Mento. He's got a new book. We had him on last year. It was our most listened to podcast of the year.
And that was episode 14. It was called The Ultimate Guide to Elvis's British Releases.
Yep. It's a good episode. If you haven't heard it, listen to that one too. On today's show, we also have a Did You Hear That? Brad's been digging deep and he's got a Did You See That? And can you tell us just a hint on what you're going to share with us?
Yeah, I'll give you a little bit of background here. We have a Did You See That from a very famous comedy starring a famous comedian. And there's an Elvis connection. But we also have a Did You Hear That from a Stax session in Memphis in 1973. The song is If You Talk In Your Sleep, and there's something kind of fun at the end that we're going to talk about.
I'm intrigued. Can't wait to hear and see that.
But we're going to start today from hearing from our guests.
We're so happy to have back to the show Gordon Mento. He's a great writer. He works for Elvis the Man, his music. He does reviews. But he's got a new book out called Elvis UK, The Ultimate Guide to Elvis Presley, British EPs, 1957 to 2001. And this is an updated version of an earlier work. And welcome to the show, Gordon.
Thank you very much, welcome. Mark. It was very nice to be back on YouTube, Brad. Thank you.
Thank you.
We had you on last year, and that was our most listened to show last year. You know, obviously, there are people wanting to hear what you have to say, and you've written this. It's a softback, 500-plus page book.
Yes.
I got a preview of it, we got a preview of it. It's really just a beautiful book, and it goes into great detail into extended play albums.
Yes.
From the UK. But I think before we get it, because there are new Elvis fans, we know there are, they contact us, and they might not know what an EP is. And could you explain what an EP is?
Yeah.
Why they existed? It's kind of interesting, the marketing of those. And then we'll get into your book.
Sure. Thanks, Mark. Well, I think the first thing to say is that, of course, EPs are, to a large extent, a redundant format these days. They enjoyed great popularity during the 1950s and 60s. But in actual fact, the last Elvis EP was Easy Come, Easy Go in 1967. And initially, I think the marketing idea behind EPs was that they were mini albums. They were actually extended, hence the word, they were extended singles. And of course, the amount of content you get onto an EP was determined by the extent of the playing time. And of course, this was obviously specific to 45 releases, so that obviously where you'd had singles, you know, with an A and a B side. I think RCA introduced the EP back in about 1952 in the States. And they kind of gradually came over into the UK around about 1954. And of course, all the major companies like EMI, which was the first company to market Elvis in the UK on its HMV label. But of course, in the States, RCA Victor, it was a very popular medium. And one of the reasons for that was it was almost like a sampler, in a sense, because you had four tracks. And, you know, if you think about the Elvis Presley album, you know, his first US album in March 56, I think, RCA took the quite unprecedented step of virtually issuing all those tracks at some point subsequently on EPs. And that was really, I think, out of deference to the fact that LPs, long players, were expensive. And of course, you've got this emerging market of young people coming along wanting to buy records, you know, by this new artist who was quite different from anybody who'd gone before. And of course, initially, younger fans probably had less money to spend. Spending capacity was increasing all the time, of course, because it was a time of, you know, increasing affluence. But LPs were still out of the range of certain people. So actually, EPs were a very good way to market these songs. And of course, they came as a mini album with a colour photograph on the front, and often you might find there were sleeve notes on the back as well. So it was kind of a compact, I mean, obviously long before compact discs, but it was a compact version of an LP album. And of course, it proved to be incredibly popular in the States. I think, last count, I mean, you probably had something like well into double figures in the first year. And when I say the first year, 1956, obviously Elvis's recordings, none of Elvis's Sun releases were on EP. They were just, you know, the five singles, but you had all of these EPs released. So it was almost like a blitz approach to it. And now, obviously, I think we've not got to forget that there's a commercial aspect to this. RCA were capitalizing on, you know, hot product. So we're releasing, you know, lots of singles, lots of EPs, and of course, a couple of albums, you know, within the first year. Really quite astonishing by today's standards, I guess. But they were very popular because they were, as I say, because they were compact, and of course they were compatible with most people's record players. So if you had the capacity to be able to play a 45, you know, if the stylus, etc., was compatible with it, then obviously you'd play a 45 RPM EP release. So it was just really an extended, and that's the name that eventually became known by. I think they were known by something else in the States, actually, Economy. I think that was the term that was used. They were called economy packages, which I guess you can see compared to the price of an LP or a single, they were kind of somewhere in the middle, and obviously had enormous appeal to people. Very sadly, though, that appeal very quickly wore thin. So, for instance, during, I think we had 22 EPs between 1957 and 1967, whereas you had well over 30. And that was out of recognition of the fact that initially in the US, you were issuing lots of kind of multiple formats. As I say, it was a blitz-like approach.
I was just wondering, what was the price difference? Do you know?
Well, I can't quote the price difference for in the US because I don't have that information. I mean, I don't know what an LP album cost at the time, or a single for that matter. But in the UK, although I was buying singles in the 1950s, it was in the late 50s, and I'm guessing we paid around about 6 shillings. I mean, it's a very old kind of denomination, whereas an extended player might have been 12 shillings. So it was like twice the price of a single, but an LP might have cost you 32 shillings. So, you know, I'm guessing that sort of differentiation in price probably existed in the US as well, because they were marketed, obviously, to teenagers predominantly. But one of the interesting things about EPs, of course, is that there were no stereo EPs at all. I mean, obviously, we know that Elvis's material wasn't recorded in proper stereo until 1960, but there were no Elvis EPs issued at all. And yet, other artists in the UK, like Cliff Richard, for instance, who was not exactly a contemporary of Elvis, but he came along a few years afterwards, modelled himself on Elvis to a large degree. EMI, the label he was on, did issue him on stereo EPs, but there were certainly none of Elvis's were issued in stereo until, I think, the EP collection in 1982, when Roger Seaman did his kind of, when he brought that format back, much to everyone's surprise, of course. So I think the price differential, though, would be probably not dissimilar in the US from what it was in the UK.
Yeah, I've got, you know, EPs, and I think some of them have written in pencil on the back, uh-huh. like $1.19 or $1.49. Yes. Sure. You know, they were. And I honestly don't know off the top of my head what albums were selling for back then, but it would have been quite a savings. And
that's because
so the kids didn't
man.
Have a lot of money. They could use mom and dad's record player.
Yes.
And then RCA started issuing these little 45 players are really cool. Yes. You see around.
Yes.
And those were probably directly marketed to teenagers. They were probably inexpensive.
Yes, they were. I mean, certainly in the UK, EPs were a popular format as well for, you know, like bands and for, I mean, like South Pacific, for instance, you know, that came out, I think, about 1958. There was an EP from that, which was in stereo, as was the album. Because obviously, I think in the US, if I'm not mistaken, I think the first stereo singles came out in about 58, mm-hmm. which, and I think, like, it's only make-believe, you know, the Conway Twitty single. I think that was one of the first singles to come out. Now, when you think, he probably recorded that not long after Elvis had done his session in Nashville in June 58. But obviously none of the Elvis material came out in stereo, and none of that was recorded in stereo as far as we know, binaural probably, but as far as we know, none of that was cut at that particular time.
I was going to add, you mentioned Conway Twitty, the interesting Elvis connection there is that I believe the Jordanaires are on It's only make-believe, correct?
Yeah, they are, absolutely. Yes, absolutely. And funny enough, you should mention that the Jordanaires, Brad, when I was listening to that podcast by Alan Stoker, that was, I found that very interesting. I'd had correspondence with Alan some years before because doesn't he work at the Nashville Music Hall of Fame or something?
Country Music Hall.
Yeah. Country Music Hall of Fame. And I'd been in touch with him and I sent him a photograph that I had taken with Gordon Stoker many years ago, I think coming out of Shoney's in Nashville. Gordon, obviously my namesake, well, I'm his namesake, I guess. He took us for a meal there, which was very generous of him, and told us some kind of real wacky tales of Elvis. But yes, they did obviously back people like that. And strangely enough, in the book, in Extended, I don't know whether you've got to this part, but we actually pay a tribute to the Jordanaires because actually, uniquely, they were the only people credited on his RCA singles and LPs,
right?
In well, almost throughout his career. I mean, because the musicians were very often neglected, whereas the vocal accompaniment, the Jordanaires, and I mean, they sang on so many. I think the estimate was around about 200 or more Elvis tracks. Mm-hmm. So we thought we'd do a piece on the Jordanaires out of deference to their contribution, because Elvis loved them and, you know, was very, I think, drawn by their talent, which was, you know, quite considerable, of course. And we thought we would demonstrate where they had appeared on, and the fact that Scotty, Bill, other guys who played, didn't ever get a credit on the RCA things, whereas the Jordanaires did. And that can only have been at Elvis's insistence, I'm guessing, and with the Colonel's permission. Because otherwise, you know, nobody else was credited on those labels. In the 60s, I suppose you got the Imperials on certain things like How Great Thou Art, and maybe the Carole Lombard Trio. Was it the Trio who were on Viva Las Vegas? I think they sang on some of those tracks.
Regarding the Jordanaires, I wonder why the Colonel would approve that. You know, it says on almost every single, I think it says Elvis Presley with the Jordanaires.
Yes. Yeah.
Yes.
And, but he held them in such high reverence. You can hear that when he introduces them on the limited live 50s shows we have. Very wonderful Jordanaires.
Yes, indeed. And that became the kind of stock phrase. And I think it had to be at Elvis's kind of insistence, really. I mean, the strange thing is, one of the things that John, my co-author, friend and co-author, what we decided to do was, went through all of the EPs where the Jordanaires are credited, and of course they are credited on things that they didn't actually sing on. And there are some songs where they're not credited and they did sing on. So for instance, on I think A Touch of Gold, they're credited with singing on One Night. I mean, they weren't on One Night, that was a solo effort. And they'll be not credited on some things that they actually did have a significant contribution towards, you know. Strange, but I think the Colonel must have relented on that because he knew how much. But there again, he didn't see the Jordanaires as a threat. They were kind of artists in their own right. And of course, unlike Scotty and Bill, who I think perhaps the Colonel felt that their influence on Elvis might have undermined his, because obviously, I don't think it's any secret, the fact that that Scotty and Bill and DJ didn't have a great deal of time for the Colonel.
Right.
And I think that was probably because of the way he treated them, too.
And the Jordanaires by 56 were a known commodity. And maybe in the Colonel's eyes, that legitimized their working with Elvis.
And I think you're right, Mark. And I think, as we mentioned, because obviously I got Alan Stoker's book and checked through it, and I really was quite astonished how far the Jordanaires went back. But of course, in a way, when Elvis spoke to them in 1955, and I think Alan Stoker recalls a conversation that his father related to him, that, you know, Elvis had said, if I ever become famous, I want you guys to sing on my records. I think Gordon Stoker says at the time, all he remembers is Elvis's outlandish appearance at that point, you know, perhaps the quite outrageous clothes for the time that he was wearing. You know, so in a way, the Jordanaires were much more famous than Elvis was in 1955. So it probably was a coup to get them on his records. And of course, you've got that, you know, that it's never been addressed fully, I don't think, but that issue with Chet Atkins, who I always admired very much as a producer and a guitar player. And, you know, who wouldn't? But there was clearly some tension between him and Elvis. And I think a lot of that relates to the fact that on those first two major sessions in 56, the Jordanaires were not there. It was just Gordon Stoker for the session in Nashville, and then the New York session, and then the one in April 56 when he did I Want You, I Need You. And of course, he hadn't got the Jordanaires together as Elvis had requested. So I think that probably soured their relationship considerably. Although that's never been, you know, that's never been verified. I don't think Chet ever said that, but I think that's the inference that people draw from it.
Yeah, I think.
Yeah, I think right. I've heard that Elvis was very upset that he didn't have all the Jordanaires there too.
Yeah, and you can understand that. And I mean, in a way, you can understand, I suppose, Chet Atkins' viewpoint there was, well, obviously, I've got the Brock brothers who had been signed to RCA around about that time. These guys, Ben and I can't remember the other guy's name, whatever it was. These guys can sing. Sorry?
Was it Ben and Brock Spears?
Yes, it was. That's correct. Yeah, okay. Thanks, Mark. You know, kind of these guys are going to ooh and ah on this record. You don't need the full Jordanaires for that, because Elvis wanted the full Jordanaires, and of course, eventually got them for Hound Dog and Don't Be Cruel and I Want You Any Way You Want Me. And of course, from thereafter, they were a regular on his sessions. And he obviously loved it.
Yeah, I probably is one of those follow the money. It's like so many things, follow the money. You know, they're paying three instead of four.
Yeah, sure.
I think Chet was, you know, he was a high up at RCA. He was just a producer. Yeah. So he was watching expenses, I'm sure.
Absolutely. Yes, absolutely. I mean, I think it's interesting that although he went on to, I don't know, kind of digressing here, but although he went on to be on Elvis's sessions, I think a lot of the time later on, he seemed to take a back seat because Elvis was recording at a time that didn't really suit Chet. Because Elvis liked to record during the night. And I mean, for instance, he's credited on that 64 session, you know, Ask Me and It Hurts Me and Memphis, mm-hmm. Tennessee, I think the recut of that. And apparently he wasn't there, but he's down on the paperwork as being there, but he wasn't. It was handled by, I'm trying to think, it was the engineer at that point. It would be Bill Porter. Other engineer as well. But apparently it's you know, because he didn't want to be hassled by that. He didn't want to be recording in the middle of the night.
I don't think he liked Elvis warming up, you know, around the piano and paying all the guys to not be producing.
Well, that's true, yes. Because I think you're right, Mark, company time, I suppose, you know, where these guys, you know, he would be having his business hat on for that kind of thing. So why would you, you know, just get on with it, do your songs, you know. Because it was, I think the expectation was four sides in a 3-hour session. That was the kind of norm, I believe, back then. I mean, it's quite ironic when you think of the times that, you know, people like Simon and Garfunkel, Eagles, Fleetwood Mac spent in a studio on one album compared to the time Elvis, you know, spent on his albums. I mean, it's laughable, really, isn't it? I remember years ago, and forgive me for digressing, and please cut this out if you want, but I remember getting the bootleg release of Something for Everybody session, and it runs for something like 80 minutes, and that's the whole session. So if you put all the outtakes back to back, it goes on a CD. Now, that's just incredible, isn't it? Yeah. And yet, you wonder what would have happened, I guess, and I suppose with Elvis, a lot of this is kind of what ifs. If he'd spent, several weeks on a particular album, you know, honing things and redoing, would they have been any better? Maybe the backings might have been better. Maybe the backings might have been more sophisticated. But, I mean, Elvis had the knack of being able to go in and sing and, you know, kind of get the tune and deliver an outstanding performance within several takes.
So your book, you know, just amazes me. You must be so disciplined to put this kind of work together. And I've just got in front of me a few pages on the Jailhouse Rock EP.
Yes, sure.
And the amount of research and the beautiful photographs and the comparisons of labels and it's really got to be a work, you know, work of love. But let's go through like your approach to this and what people who are interested in the book, what they could expect. And eventually we'll talk about how they can get the book and so forth.
Sure. Well, I think initially, I think what's worth saying, Mark, is that John Townsend, who's my co-author, to be honest, and I'd have to say this outright now, that much as I love writing about Elvis and aspects of Elvis's career and his records, etc., if John wasn't around, then there would be no Elvis UK. books, because John is a driving force behind this. He does a lot of stuff behind the scenes. So he has an amazing capacity for research, etc. So he often will come up with the ideas, or, you know, why don't we do something on such and such? And we, you know, because we'd done this book back in 1987, the original book, which was Elvis UK, The Ultimate Guide to Elvis Presley's British LP, I think, vinyl releases. I've got the title slightly wrong there, but it covered all of the, you know, the vinyl, like the singles, EPs and the LPs. In that particular book, we were constrained by the fact that we were producing a book that was really out of left field. Nobody had done anything like that before for any other artist. That's not a boast. That is just a fact. Nobody had done a book of that nature before, in, to that degree of detail. And we were fortunate enough to get a publisher to publish it for us. The truth is, probably two-thirds of the way through the process, the publisher was probably thinking of actually binning this project, because it became so complex and became so complicated. And that's not what, you know, I mean, obviously they have to pour money into doing this. So the book ended up being very expensive. We had to edit that book. Well, we edited it ourselves, of course. We do all the writing and the editing ourselves. But what we were very aware of was that we'd had to cut out certain things when we were doing that book originally. And it was with the benefit of hindsight, and of course, other collectors coming along and saying, well, actually, you didn't mention X, Y, or Z. We started collecting more information. So it's been incremental over a number of years. And all the while, we've been amassing, you know, for instance, label scans, because, you know, that's a particularly kind of fastidious and nerdish aspect of collecting. You know, the fact that a record's got a different label. It's the same song or same songs, but it's a different label, and it's got some movement of the detail. And to some people, they would find that absolutely ridiculous, because actually all they're interested in is what's the title of the song, perhaps who wrote it, who's the artist. The rest of the detail is kind of immaterial. But we felt that there was a kind of story to be told there, and our mission was to try and look at this and make it the ultimate guide, which is, you know, the kind of the recurring theme throughout all of these books, the ultimate guide to. So we have collected material from other fans, other collectors, friends, and actually collated all of this stuff. But we wanted to make it so it was a story as well, because that, we felt that was important. You know, our view is that you can produce a document that has those label scans on, and that's not terribly difficult, actually. Although, obviously, putting in the order in which they came is a bit more problematic, because you've got to know why you're putting one before another. But we wanted to make sure that there was a context for all of these things. So, for instance, in Jailhouse Rock, you know, Jailhouse Rock is a particularly interesting EP for us. I mean, not only does it have, I think we've got something like 46 label variations noted in there, which is astonishing. And that was available in the UK through to 1973. So it came out in January 58. So through to 1973, it was still on catalogue and it was still selling. It wouldn't have been on catalogue had it not been selling. And then, of course, ultimately, when EPs were dropped in 1967 as new entities, but they kept a handful of Elvis EPs on catalogue through to 1973. So John and I's mission was, okay, what can we, what we want to give people as much information as we can about Jailhouse Rock. And I think, I'm not quite sure whether we did it on this one, but we talk about the session as well. Now, you know, sessions are covered very comprehensively, like by people like Keith Flynn, you know, a friend of mine, and of course, Ernst Jürgensen, you know, who has done the kind of ultimate sessions work, because he got access to all of that stuff. But we wanted to just talk about, you know, kind of how those sessions came about. And in particular, and I think it's part of the Jailhouse Rock that you're referring to, in particular, we want to pay tribute to Lieber and Staller, because they were pivotal people in Elvis's career at that time. And I mean, the tragedy is, as we know, that probably during the King Creole sessions in January 58, the story goes that probably overstepped the mark a little bit, and were trying to kind of steer Elvis in a certain direction, which Colonel Parker took exception to, and basically they were told to butt out. And they were very hot songwriters. They didn't need this guy telling them, you know, kind of what to do. So we do pay tribute to the fact that Elvis recorded so many Lieber and Staller songs, pre 1968, 1958, sorry. But then thereafter, although he did record some of the songs, they weren't written specifically for him. But the Jailhouse Rock is interesting because you've got all of those label variations, and you've got all of those sleeve variations as well, because actually with each generation, we were fortunate that some of the printers for the UK sleeves, they would actually put a date stamp on the bottom of the back cover. So it might have like 7/58, obviously relating to July 1958, etc. So our mission has always been, not just with Jailhouse Rock, of course, but with anything that we're approaching, is to look at it in the round and think, okay, what would we like to read about? If we were reading about EPs, what is it that we would like to read about? So we put ourselves as collectors and fans ourselves in the position of other people and think, okay. And of course, there are times when we say, no, we've gone too far with that. Maybe that detail has become a bit, too nerdish and too distant from its topic. But having said that, obviously, you mentioned this earlier on, Mark. I mean, the fact is, in Elvis UK, the original book back in 1987, EPs, we devoted 50 pages or thereabouts to EPs. This book has 500 pages. So that is the extent of the depth to which we've gone on this. And we want to make this, in a way, the last word. And that's kind of part of our mission. However, that said, we have to say that there are possibly bits of information that are not in there, because as people get the book, they will come back and say, actually, I remember such and such. So there may be a label variation that we haven't managed to include. But that would tell you two things. One is how rare that label variation is, and how few there are about. Because if we've not seen it, then it's a good chance that it doesn't exist. But, we try to steer from saying that this is, there's never going to be anything else on EPs. There'll never be another book on EPs from us, because we've done that work now. But I don't think anybody is going to be in a position to top that. But I think one of the things that, just one of the questions you asked there was, of interest to US fans, well, is that not all of the US EPs were issued in the UK, and conversely, not all of the UK EPs were issued in the US. So we've actually, where there is a correlation, we've talked about, both versions, etc. So for instance, Love Me Tender, that had a completely different label, completely different sleeve design in the UK. It was a shot actually from a rehearsal scene, where he's singing on the porch. Now that's in black and white, whereas the US one was colour. But later on, we had no Loving You EPs, for instance. We just had a 10-inch Loving You LP, which had 8 tracks on it. You had a couple of EPs. You had an LP, which had 12 tracks on. So we've kind of crossed over, so that we're trying to make sure that we're covering all bases on this. Because people might ask themselves the question, well, what did they do in the States? We had a Such a Night EP in 1960. The US didn't. But other parts of Europe did. We had a 4-track EP that came out from Elvis's back, but there was no EP issued in the States, even though, ironically, there is a US number on it, but it wasn't on catalogue. So you get quirks like that that we want to draw to people's attention.
And you have pictures of, I'm looking at the Jailhouse Rock, you have the UK version, a picture of that, and yes, a picture, yes, of the US, so you can compare, yes, the...
Absolutely, yes. And that was kind of important for us. I mean, obviously, we've got friends who've got access to these things, and, we'll send us scans, etc. Although the major work is done by John and myself, we have to pay tribute to the people who contributed to this in however small a way they may think it is. If they've given us a piece of information or sent us a scan or told us about something, then we've incorporated, then they get the name mentioned in the book, because, it's a collaborative effort in that sense. We're not trying to steal anybody's thunder. But I think it's about just that rigor that we bring to it. And you're right, it's almost become a job. I mean, it's a hobby, but it's become a job because we take it seriously. We want it to be literate. We want it to be correct. I think we're all fed up of seeing books where they've not been proofread properly. They're not being particularly well put together. And that's, really irksome, particularly when you're paying very large sums of money. And And indeed, I might mention that's another thing that we wanted to make sure that this book was affordable, which is why, you know, this one really retails in the UK for something like £58, which I'm guessing is probably about $80 or thereabouts. Mm-hmm. What we want to do is make it readable. We want to make it interesting. We want to capture people's attention. And in a way, one of the things that that John and I both find very rewarding is when people come back and say, we really enjoyed reading that. I didn't know that or something. We think, well, actually, if we've done that, then actually we've fulfilled a role. And I think what's important for us particularly was the dating of those records that you're talking about, Mark. You know, say the 46 label variations there are, the known ones, I should say, that actually things like tax codes, which were a feature that appeared on British records from around about 1960.
What is that? I never.
Well, basically, in the UK, when you bought something in a shop, well, unlike in the States, where, and forgive me if I'm getting this wrong, but you buy something in the States, you take it to the checkout, and then they say they'll charge you, say it's $2, and they'll say, well, the local tax is 10% or 15% or whatever it happens to be, and add that on at the point of sale. In the UK, that's never been the case. When you see a product priced in a shop or in a restaurant or whatever, it includes tax. And our purchase tax was basically just a tax by the government on a variety of products. But it was always inherent in a product. So on a record label, if you saw, for instance, that it had a PT tax code, and again, it comes back to what I said earlier on, most people who bought a record with a PT tax code on couldn't care less what PT meant. It's just a squiggle on a record label. But of course, what we discovered, and I've got to say this was John's incredible research back in the 1980s. He discovered that those were symbols which were requirements by the government for record companies to put on their record labels to prove that tax had been paid on that particular product. But the useful thing it was, we were able to marry up those different tax codes. The great thing about that, for instance, is that if you're a record collector and you want the same, you're buying the same record but with different label formats, was that if you've got a record with PT on it, you can actually pinpoint that to actually down to November 1962, November, December 1962, because the tax rate changed in January 1963. So if a record has that on, you know it had to have been manufactured while that tax code was pertinent to that particular product. The fact of the matter is to collectors, they are that's, you know, great pointers, indicators. And of course, in the UK, the other side of it was that we went from RCA to, at the end of 1962, RCA Victor, because I think it's always been known as RCA Victor in the States on Elvis Records. But it went from RCA logo to RCA Victor. And then, of course, in 1969, they went onto the orange label, which I think that was probably used in lots of parts of the world. That was a new company identity, in a way. So those things, they're very helpful in sorting out variations. And I've got to say, my friend John, he's particularly adept at working these things out. He has a laser-like focus on these things.
And just to be clear, this is it's really a reference book and a history book. It's not a value book.
No, it isn't. And I'm grateful you mentioned that, Mark, because actually from the very first, when we produced Elvis UK back in 1987, we were very clear that there's no point. You know, I know the price guides are issued, but the problem is, as soon as you issue them, the likelihood is they're going to be out of date. Price guides can be helpful, but actually they can overinflate things that are not really worth very much and underestimate other things. I mean, our view, and, you know, both as collectors and private individuals, is that something is only ever worth what somebody's prepared to pay you for it.
Right.
So, you know, how do you put a value on Sun singles, for instance? You know, I mean, the Sun singles, which are the holy grail for every Elvis fan. I mean, I've never collected US material as a general rule because I couldn't afford to do that when I was younger. By the time I could, it was kind of late in the day. But the only things I would have ever wanted to have had and ever would cherish would be obviously the Sun 45s, because they are, well, the holy grail. You can't get any better than that. No. For the sound of them and the look of them, etc. The only thing I would say is that by inference, if you like, if something is very rare, if there's not very many of them around, then the likelihood is that they're going to become desirable. But as to what somebody's prepared to pay for them, well, that's down to whatever you negotiate with somebody. And to put an artificial price on something is, I don't think, terribly helpful, actually. In fact, it can be counterproductive because you can put people off. So we prefer to say, look, there were lots of these made. If I can just give you a random example of this, not on EPs, but on LPs. For instance, in 1978, RCA in the UK, obviously this was a year after Elvis died, they decided to issue that album, that 40 Greatest Hits album, which had been on the Arcade label in the UK. Because, would you backtrack slightly, you know, the buyout in 73 when the Colonel sold, you know, the back catalogue stuff. Well, that allowed RCA to license, obviously, a lot of the Elvis tracks to third parties. And, of course, in the UK, they did that with this 40 Greatest Hits. So that came out, sold like it was going out of style. I mean, it sold phenomenal amounts of money. Now, RCA will have made money because of the licensing agreement they had, but actually not as much money they would have made if they produced the record themselves in the first place. But a company had saw a niche market and actually exploited that with telesales, which RCA were not into that in the UK at the time. But then in 78, after the contract had run out with Arcade, it was a three-year contract they had with them, they decided they would issue the 40 Greatest themselves. And they did it in pink vinyl. Nowadays, people say, oh, well, I've got a pink vinyl copy of, you know, the 40 Greatest Hits. I mean, that's very rare. No, it isn't. Actually, the rare one is, or the rarer of the two, is the black vinyl one, because like the world and his wife have got a copy of the pink one. But because it was a different coloured vinyl at that time, later on people assume that's going to be the rare one. It isn't. So I think we've said, I think in this book and probably other books, it's always a case of buyer beware. You know, check things out and check out things with people who are perhaps a little bit more knowledgeable, have a bit more experience before you commit your hard-earned money to buying something that may well not be worth anything at all.
That reminds me, I collect records, as you know, and I don't know how many people have told me, I've got this Moody Blue album and it's on blue vinyl.
Uh-huh. And, yeah.
You have one on black?
Yeah, sure. Yeah. I think what we're intending the book to be is a reference book for people. It's not just meant to be a list of, labels, because actually what you need is some guide as to what those labels mean, what's behind all that. And of course, that's where, you know, a lot of this key research that John's responsible for and kind of my contribution is, you know, writing it, editing, et cetera, and adding my 10 cents worth. It's probably for the casual fan as well, if they're interested. But you know, the main market is kind of the serious collector who wants to know everything there is to know about Elvis's UK EPs, but also that's cross-referenced with, as I say, with the US ones as well.
But if somebody had, an Elvis collection for sale, or you're looking to buy all of it or just part of it, this would be a great book to bring along.
And yes, yes.
Especially that tax code thing, that's cool. You could really narrow down when it was actually.
You know, we have a chart, or we like... John and I like to have what they call them, like a grid. So you have titles and etc., real estate, etc. So it's all in a digestible form, so people can flick to that and see, okay, if there's an ET tax code or an OT, a ZT or whatever it happens to be, then you can look down and cross check. So that will tell you when that record, that period of time during which that record was made. So unfortunately, it's not infallible, and we make that very clear to people. But on the other hand, I think it's the important thing is to make sure that we're giving people as much information as they're likely to need for this. We mentioned that one of our contributors had said that he had an EP with an inner sleeve, you know, one of these like you get on LP albums, you know, but it was made of like a paper sleeve. We were wondering why some people had those in their EPs, because it wasn't universal right across the range. Anyway, one of our readers, who's from Northern Ireland, I was just talking to him about an hour and a half ago. He bought the book and he came back to me and he said, I think I can answer this question for you. So that's great for us, because what he said was, that actually those inner sleeves on EPs, certainly in the UK, were only used where there was a stereo EP. And of course, none of the Elvis EPs were in stereo. So if any of the mono ones had an inner sleeve, that was probably accidental. At the factory, somebody stuck it in a sleeve accidentally or after it's been bought. Now, that's a, you know, it's a very minor example, but it's a, but it is a pertinent example of that interplay that we still get feedback because we were not able to offer any definitive advice on why that should be. Why somebody said, I bought this with an inner sleeve. Well, that wasn't the practice by RCA. RCA records were released in the UK by Decca from 1957 through to, well, 1970 when they went onto the Orange label. That wasn't the practice. But it turns out that if you were an artist with an artist who had a stereo EP, Cliff Richard, for instance, EMI produced his both in mono and stereo, chances are, if you had the stylus to play the stereo, you would have got a stereo EP in an inner sleeve.
RCA had the orange label, blue label, and tan label, correct? What's the difference? Why is that?
Well, they didn't. Well, in fact, it's just the company identity, Brad.
Okay. I
mean, basically, you know, it was a kind of, I suppose, with all product, whether it's records or, you know, whatever you buy, cars, you know, all consumable goods, I suppose companies have a, you know, they have a logo. And from time to time, they'll want to refresh that logo. And certainly in end of 1968, which was the end of the black label things, I think, uh-huh, throughout the world, as far as I recall, they had a corporate identity, and that was the orange RCA label. You mentioned the tan labels. We didn't have those. We only ever got occasional singles in tan, but they were imported. So, for instance, if there was a 73, 74 time, there was a vinyl shortage in Europe, owing to the oil crisis in the Middle East. So actually they were having to import vinyl copies from the US. So for instance, we would get albums or singles from the US that were imported, but given a British catalog number, maybe an over stamp on the back of the LP or the label, whatever. But that's just simply about company identity. And of course the Blue Elvis label, well, that was a real, you know, that was a real good thing. Cause I mean, when you think about that, that is specific to Elvis. You can't use that blue label for anybody else. Whereas the orange label, that would be relevant for Eddie Arnold, Jim Reeves, and whoever else was on RCA at the time. You know, so, I mean, and I guess this is one of the things that we mentioned. I think we mentioned it in this book, maybe on the next book that I've got to be careful I don't get confused here because we've just finished another one.
Oh, wow.
Yes, and I can tell you it's actually on 78 RPMs.
Oh my gosh.
Which is, so yes, I mean, that's finished and that's kind of on the stocks ready to go. We can't stop ourselves, I'm afraid. But what we're saying there, you know, about the labels is that, you remember, a label will have the company features over which you would stamp the particular artist. So for instance, you know, the RCA and the copyright details around, usually around the circumference on the LP or single, and, you know, kind of any company identifiers would be standard to all of the artists who are on that label, but you then overstamp. So it's invariably a two-stage process. You would overstamp the actual information on, you know, relating to that particular release with the artist, the title, etc. And occasionally, that's why you get mismatches. You'll get another artist on a B side of an Elvis. It'll play Elvis, but actually, it's a rogue label that's got somewhere in the process. And of course, you know, at factories, people are not particularly bothered about that because, you know, these guys are knocking out hundreds, thousands a day. I mean, they're not going to go through every one. They just rely on the consumer saying, hey, you know, my Elvis record doesn't have Elvis on the other side. So you take it back to your dealer and you'd get your money back, or the dealer would maybe throw it away. But of course, to collectors now, that's, again, sure, for no other reason that it's different, and that's the nature of collecting. I'm sad to say I'm kind of a hopeless case on this, you know, although I am getting therapy for it.
Well, you're just such a wealth of knowledge in it. In just the short time we spoke, you can, that comes through, and that, and just on the EPs, we have 500 pages of this knowledge disseminated. Is there a way listeners can, or a place they can go to kind of get a preview of the book and the details?
Well, to get more details, Mark, yes. I mean, there are two places that can go. One is our own website, which is www.elvisukbooks.co.uk, or to order any product like this. We're still doing some of our digital copies of books, This particular one isn't available as a digital copy. It's only available as a print copy. And that was by really popular demand, if you like. People happy to have digital, but more people want a physical product, which is why we've gone down that route now. Or they can go to ndnowdigthis. Again, that'll be www.nowdigthis.co.uk. And they're the people who produce the Elvis, the Man in His Music magazine. At the moment, Trevor Caggio, who's a very old friend of mine, he and his wife are doing the fulfillment side of this. So I don't know what the overseas postage is on this. I mean, the regrettable thing is for any books, of course, is that the postage is often the killer for people because, you know, the price of the book may be okay. So whilst the price of the book in the UK, the price that's quoted, £58, incorporates UK postage, obviously for overseas, whether that's Europe or beyond in the US, then the postage rates are higher. But obviously we have no control over that whatsoever. But anybody wanting to find out more, then there's more information there. I mean, if I can just mention, just as another bit of detail, is that, you know, the Tickle Me EPs, well, we had two in the UK, whereas, you know, one a five-track EP and there was a four-track EP, volume two, whereas in the US, you only had one because you had two singles that were culled from that soundtrack, whereas RCA in the UK decided they would have a volume two. And it was a bit cheeky, really, because they... Again, they didn't use a different cover. It was exactly the same cover. You know, Elvis, a Tickle Me shot. Elvis was standing with his Gibson guitar, and they used the same cover, which is a bit cheap, really. But again, we go into all that. Well, yeah, it is, because actually we were, you know, in a way we were cheated, as we were on King Creole, as it just occurs to me, that King Creole, you had volume one, volume two, the EPs, and there's a good example of, you know, talk about getting your money's worth, you know, 11-track LP, a single, Hard-Headed Woman. We had an 11-track LP. We had two singles because we had Hard-Headed Woman and King Creole, the lead track. And so it was a bit of a mystery why they didn't choose King Creole as the primary single. And then we had two EPs. So literally the only track that wasn't issued either on LP or a single at the time, on single or EP, was Steadfast, Loyal and True. Understood. So 11 tracks were, but of course in our volume two of the King Creole EP, we have the same cover as the volume one, which was a reverse image shot. So it's actually, again, that's a real insult that you get a reverse image shot of Elvis, mm-hmm. where he's, you know, you can tell his reverse image. I don't know about you, but that really irritates me.
That irritates me too.
Yeah, you know, I mean, it's so sloppy, isn't it?
And, it is. And far through the process.
Yeah. I know it's just unwarranted, but so yes. Anyway, that's where we're at.
You know, you mentioned cheap. Was it Separate Ways cheap? You know, yes. Separate Ways, yes. Camden. Yeah. My gosh,
yes, it was.
That's a bizarre cover, is it not?
It's just so.
It is. Well, you know, we did that, and I don't know. Did we talk about this last year? Because I think we talked about January last year, wasn't it? Was that the book we were talking about? Cover Story, which was only. We did all the covers for the EPs and the LPs. And of course, we talked about, you know, Elvis is standing on the US one. He's standing across a freeway. Well, of course, at that time, we didn't have freeways in the UK. We had motorways. I mean, obviously, you know, he's straddling. I mean, how absurd. And of course, you know, and I guess you've got that it's like a visual pun, isn't it? That he's standing astride to think the Separate Ways. Traffic's going one way. I mean, how cheap is that? Somebody either got paid for that.
Yeah, it probably took 5 minutes and then they went on a break.
Oh, I don't think it'll have spent that long, Mark.
Yeah.
I think the guy will have said, I think this will do. And it was a Camden. So, you know.
Yeah. He was a cash cow by then. He
absolutely
would sell. Yeah. And they're probably at that time more interested in John Denver on RCA then.
Yeah, or Hall and Oates, because were the early 70s?
They were
very big.
Charlie Pride was on.
Charlie Pride, yes.
But just to be clear now, on the book, wherever you are in the world, it is available by
absolutely.
Mail.
Yes, absolutely. It can be sent out to anywhere in the world, and obviously you'll get the prices for that, or if you go onto the nowdigthis.co.uk website. The other people are handling the book for us. So, and if anybody's unsure, they can contact us at Elvis UK, Elvis UK Books, .co.uk, There's an information thing. So going on to our website, if anybody's got any queries, you know, want to ask any or make a point, any feedback, we're very happy to receive that through that medium.
It's got a beautiful cover, and you've got a one sheet on all the features, and people can learn more about it in detail.
Absolutely.
That way.
Actually, so. On the cover, Mark, I'd want to mention that the cover we designed was by a friend of John's who's not an Elvis fan at all, but he comes up with some really good ideas. And of course, that obviously the title of the book is Elvis UK Extended, and then with the subtitle, you know, the Ultimate Guide. And of course, the shot is from the Tupelo concert in 26th of September 1956, where he's reaching out, you know, that newsreel footage. And I just like that idea. Again, possibly a bit corny, but it's actually extended. And so you've got the visual impact there as well.
I
love it. So that's
an iconic photo for sure.
It is. It is indeed. Yeah.
He could just look iconic without trying.
He could. He could indeed. And actually, it's worth mentioning, I think, that throughout the book, we try to include some unusual, we're not going to say they are rare or previously unpublished photographs, because who can say that these days? I mean, I think David English and Paul Granlund can say it, because they usually have bought a new set of photographs, you know, for their FTD books. But we've included a lot of photographs in there, which are quite unusual, I think, of Elvis, you know, to not to pad things out at all, but just simply to help the layout. So it's pleasing on the eye. So
it is.
Photographs on Elvis, you got those two.
I mean, I've had a chance to look at all 500 pages, but what I skimmed through, it just, the layout's beautiful, the pictures.
Thank you very much.
It's really nice.
So. I'm just a bit disappointed that you've been devoting some time to your actual daytime job, as opposed to.
I have been emailing you when I should be working. Don't tell anybody.
No, I'll not tell your boss. That's okay.
Okay, thanks, Gordon. Right, we could talk all day, but
indeed,
we're
out of time. Sure, yeah.
It's grateful, been
great to talk to you guys.
Took so much time today.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks for the opportunity to talk to you again, and I've enjoyed it immensely.
Memphis Flash will be right back, but first, a word from our sponsor. Brad, we've talked about shopping at Lansky's when you're in Memphis, but what if you're not in Memphis?
That's easy. Shop at Lansky's online at LanskyBros.com. And while visiting their website, be sure to get on their email list. It's like a little piece of Memphis coming to you for a visit. Shop for men's and women's clothes and accessories.
And of course, Lansky's was Elvis's favorite place to shop for clothes. Click on the Clothier to the King tab on the Lansky website, and dozens of Elvis-related items come up. And check out the 16 pages of celebrities pictured shopping at Lansky's.
And if you are looking for a gift, just click on the Accessories tab, and dozens of great men's and women's gift ideas come up, from perfume to jewelry, socks to leather pouches to wallets. When you do visit Memphis, be sure to put a trip to Lansky's at the Peabody Hotel on your list. While there, see the world-famous ducks and look over the city of Memphis and the Mississippi River from the rooftop of the Peabody Hotel.
Or if you can't be in Memphis, shop online at LanskyBros.com. That's LanskyBros.com. Lansky Brothers, Clothier to the King.
Shop like a king.
Dress like a rock star.
Iconic style since 1946. And now, back to the show. So, Mark, it was very interesting to hear of EPs.
In the UK. Gordon's just a wealth of knowledge, and I had that sneak peek. It's a great book. People should go to those websites he mentioned and check it out.
Mark, one thing I find very interesting, I had always thought that EP only stood for extended play. We found something
else. That's what I thought too. And it's in America, it was
economy package.
Economy package, yeah.
Right. So
why did we think it was the UK term being Americans?
It must be the most used term. I wonder how many Americans know that.
I don't know.
They're going to get this book and they'll find out otherwise.
I guess. Well, yeah. So very interesting. Great.
Matter of fact, if you want to get the book, you can actually go to nowdigthis.co.uk, or you can go to elvisukbooks.co.uk. And now it's time for a segment we'd like to call.
Did you see that?
Today on Did You See That? I'm a big Steve Martin fan. I'm a huge fan of the movie called The Jerk. And I think you are too, Mark, right?
Yeah, my wife especially likes that movie.
Great movie.
Steve Martin, yeah.
This thing came out about 1979. Interesting fact here, Steve Martin early on in the 70s opened up for, did he open up for Elvis or no? Excuse me.
Well, he opened for Ann Margaret.
He opened for Ann Margaret and he met Elvis in backstage, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, because Elvis was at the show. And what did Elvis say to Steve Martin?
Steve Martin was on, I think, David Letterman telling the story.
Right.
It's on YouTube like everything. And And I think he said Elvis said that you have an oblique sense of humor. And he says, I do too, but my fans don't understand it.
I love it.
So
if you this can is find probably that, early 70s, right? Like 70.
Yeah, he was with Priscilla. He said,
okay,
they were together.
Yeah.
So,
wow.
So yeah, it's pretty funny to hear him tell the story. So yeah.
Well, what's cool about this is that they had met, and then let's fast forward, it's called 8 years, the jerk comes out, and there is a scene. I guess you could say that there's a woman coming on to Steve Martin's character in a trailer. And at right about 1 minute, 23 seconds, we will have this on our social media. You can see a poster of Elvis in the background, and he's wearing the Burn Love jumpsuit, which tells us that it is 1972. So the female character, that was her trailer, and you see an Elvis poster. So there's a relevance 2 years after Elvis died, and he's right there looking over.
Neat. That's a good one.
A good catch, wasn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, it was a good catch. Good eye.
How was it I'd never noticed that before? I think we had this discussion, and you hadn't either.
I hadn't either. I haven't seen that in a long time, but I don't remember seeing it.
Go to it, check it out. It's pretty cool.
Yeah.
So we hope you enjoyed that little snippet of The Jerk. And now it's time for a segment we'd like to call Did You Hear That? And on Did You Hear That today, we have a famous track from Stax Records recorded in Memphis 1973. The song is If You Talk In Your Sleep. And at the very end of the song, right at 2 minutes, 21 seconds, listen carefully as the song fades, you can hear Elvis chuckle, right? And after he chuckles, he says something, and I don't quite know what he says. He repeats, you know, kind of a line in the song, and I think he's saying the line. I'm not sure what he's doing. I wish I really knew what he was saying, but I've never really noticed that till I gave it a listen the other day. And I don't know if Mark, you know what I'm talking about, but you can listen to it at 2 minutes and 21 seconds if you talk in your sleep.
And that's on the master recording.
That's on the master recording, yeah.
So if we went into the session on an FTD, we might hear it.
Yeah, I was trying to find a undubbed, you know, master without the backing vocals. I think you would hear exactly what he says, chuckling, because the song fades. And what was always interesting to me is that they did not cut it out. Why not just cut it out? They're releasing it, cut it out, and, you know, or just cut that vocal out. But they kept it. He chuckled and said something, and then it fades to the end.
That's cool. I'll check that out.
You bet. At 2 minutes, 21 seconds.
I think he had fun with that song because of the subject matter, you know.
Right. It was penned by Red West, his buddy.
By Red West. And then there's a great quality recording of him doing that live. It's just awesome. And at the end, he kind of kids about, he says, I don't do that stuff. I didn't write that song. And then he says, Charlie did.
Charlie Hyde. That's 74, right?
Yeah. So if you can find that, it's pretty funny.
And that song also, it just epitomizes the 70s, the sound, the groove. Funky. Yeah. Very like Shaft-esque.
Yeah. It could be on Starsky and Hutch or something. Or
absolutely.
Yeah.
Great tune.
Yeah. That Stax. It has that Stax sound, the horns.
Oh, absolutely.
Maybe being in Stax inspired that.
I think it did.
Well, that's a good one. Another good one.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you, Brad.
I got to thank our research team for that.
Yeah.
Going to take them to lunch.
BB and company. Well, Brad, before we go, we want to say another big thank you to Gordon Mento for being our guest today.
We had a blast. Thanks, Gordon. And hopefully we'll have him on again.
Well, he's got that book coming out about 78s now. So
he does.
I do not collect those anymore because I have broken too many. So
they're like a platter. I mean, come on, like a literal, you know, you could eat dinner off of it.
Yeah, they're just so breakable. I just stay away from those. So anyway, I'm be interested to hear what he has to say about those. So we'll have him back in the future. We want to thank everybody for listening. Brad, tell them how they can reach us.
If you'd like to email us, you can simply email memphisflashpodcast@gmail.com. And we also have a social media page. It's Memphis Flash Podcast on Facebook. If you'd like to see some content.
Well, Brad, it's been fun today and great to see you again. And I'm looking forward to our next podcast. But until then,
we'll catch you on the flip side.
Memphis Flash is written and produced by Brad Burkadahl, Mark Schaefer, and Anna Burkadahl. Original music written and performed by Brad Burkadahl. Don't forget to visit Memphis Flash Podcast on Facebook and Instagram for special content related to this and other episodes. Have a topic you'd like us to cover or just want to say hi? Email us at memphisflashpodcast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.